Yeti or a vulnerable snowman. Call it what you may.
The elusive Bigfoot.
Bigfoot, I mean, I can't believe you. Bigfoot.
I love Bigfoot.
Bigfoot also may be a form of primal man that did not become extinct as believed, but developed independently.
Some say it can't be that no man is that big or that strong or could make so hideous a sound.
The sounds could not have been made by man or any known animal.
Proof would be film of the monster.
Unfortunately, to scientists, that's not very important.
We need a piece of the body. Nothing else will be accepted.
I think that there are many other ways of proving an existence of something other than killing that particular thing that you're trying to prove exists.
They believe the hunt will end with a bullet.
Grizzly as that sounds, I think that is probably what we'll have to do.
They could be a hominid form. It could be a man. To shoot one would be totally wrong.
You're crazy.
I wish Bigfoot were my dad.
I know they are nearby and that there will be more and more sightings.
From the high peaks of the Cascades to the boggy bottoms in the lowlands, welcome wherever you may be to Sasquatch Tracks, where we go in pursuit of answers to the mystery of relict hominoids and on the track of unknown animals. Whether you're a day dweller or a nocturnal night goer, we are coming to you on demand via podcasting apps everywhere around the world, and of course, direct from a bunker below ground nestled deeply beneath the Appalachian Institute for Hominology Studies. Joining me as always, Jeffrey and Smo. How are you gentlemen doing in your respective bunkers this evening?
Doing great. Man, it feels good to be back on the microphone with you guys. It's been a while.
That's right.
It's been a hot minute.
Yeah, well, I've been in the bunker south, as in South America, in recent...
I get another hemisphere.
That's right, yeah. Another time zone, and certainly in another hemisphere. The sky looks a little different down there, and I'll tell you one thing I didn't see anything of when I was in South America. That was Bigfoot.
No. That's okay, though. He may still be there. I don't know.
Well, you know, it seems that there is not very much in the way of relict hominoids in South America. I mean, you have some of those disputed instances, like the Delois ape. There are the accounts that I believe Percy Fawcett came back and told. But again, in his case, it was very obviously the indigenous residents that were being described, and people have tried to, you know, project hopeful ideas about Sasquatch and relict hominoids onto that. That's not the case. As far as the Delois ape, that's an interesting story. You guys remember the famous photograph I'm talking about, right? If you nod your head, they can't hear you at home.
Well, I'm racking my brain. I don't know that I've seen. I'll have to look it up, and maybe I have, and I just don't know it.
Well, for everyone at home who may not be familiar with the story here, okay, if you go online, look for D-E-L-O-Y-S, Delois ape. And anyone, of course, at home who is now curious about what we're discussing, Amaranthropoids loisi is the proposed taxonomical name for this disputed species. That name unofficially for a primate that was encountered and allegedly killed by Francois Delois in South America. And you can read about this online on various sites. I think there's even like a Wikipedia page for it. But again, there's an article most recently that appeared at Forbes, I think in 2016, titled Delois Ape Was a Well-Played Anthropological Fraud. Indeed, the story that Delois gives us is that he encountered two of these, and that these two mysterious upright-walking apes emerge from the jungle, behaving in a threatening manner. And so they shoot and they kill presumably the male specimen. They prop it up on a box. They have a stick under its chin to hold its head aloft, and they take a photograph of this thing, the dead monkey sitting on this box. That's the photo that you'll see when you go online and look this up. But modern analysts who have looked at the photo say, no, that's not a giant, you know, man-sized ape. That's like a spider monkey sitting on a matchbox. It was all just a joke. It was a hoax. This never really happened. That's not an unrecognized, you know, species of ape or anything else. That is a known species, and it was much smaller than what the men in question, the hoaxers, as it turns out, had claimed.
It's all a matter of perspective, it sounds like.
Well, in this case, it actually was. But of course, the broader point is that while in South America, really, again, there are very few traditions about relict hominoids in that part of the world, which is interesting to me for a couple of reasons. One of them being, if early humans could travel across the Bering Land Bridge when that existed toward the end of the Pleistocene, and they could make their way into North America, presumably other species could too. Maybe even something like Gigantopithecus. And so I'm interested in the idea that if humans disperse throughout North America and South America because they are hunter-gatherers and they're constantly on the move, but let's say there are other kinds of animal species, they aren't so much on the hunting side of things. I mean, not to say that Sasquatch doesn't hunt, but most observations of Sasquatch describe, you know, an omnivore I mean, in fact, actually, in a majority maybe of sightings, especially from the Pacific Northwest, Sasquatch, you know, they're often seen eating. You think about William Rowe. Mm-hmm. You think about the Ruby Creek incident. You know, the Sasquatch is most often doing what you'd expect a very large animal that requires food to sustain itself to be doing. It's looking for food. Mm-hmm. But if you are a giant megafaunal ape and you arrive in the montane forests of the Pacific Northwest, you're big, okay, you're a megafaunal ape species, you've got the body mass to sustain yourself in a cold environment, but there's a lot of, you know, greenery, I mean, plenty to subsist off of in terms of vegetation. But there along the coastlines, you've also got a lot of protein-rich, you know, mussels and different kinds of sources of food right there on the coast as well. And that primarily throughout the year. You've got the salmon runs. Mm-hmm. So here you've got nature's superfood right there at your disposal. Here again, what do the indigenous American legends talk about? They always say that these things steal the salmon from men's nets. Mm-hmm. If you are coexisting in an environment where you have another species, humans, and you're watching these guys fish with their nets, and they're like, okay, this is easy, really easy. Those guys catch the fish for us. We wait until they walk away from the net. And then what do? We go over there and we take the fish. I mean, why would they ever really leave the Pacific Northwest? Now, of course, there are sightings of Sasquatch that reportedly occur all over the place, but I maintain that there is probably the best concentration of what seemed to be the most valid sightings still in the Pacific Northwest. It sounds an awful lot to me like a species that has essentially remained in that geographic area where it has been able to subsist for, I mean, thousands of years. Why go outside of an area where you can thrive successfully? That definitely is one aspect of their behavior and their subsistence patterns that's maybe a little different from humans, but it makes a lot of sense, especially in terms of how humans even are expected to have, for the most part, made their way into North America. So why didn't Sasquatch do the same thing? Why couldn't it have? You know, kind of makes a lot of sense to me. But again, coming back to South America, the fact that there are so few sightings and stories of any kind in that part of the world actually makes a lot of sense anthropologically.
Thinking about the Pacific Northwest and just how human behavior is too, and if they have any sort of human-like behavior, I mean, certain people and certain groups of people find the environments that they're most comfortable in. I mean, I love being here in the South, and especially where we are in North Carolina, you get a little bit of everything. You get all the seasons. Then again, there's some people who love the, like, really hot climates. I couldn't live in Florida. It stays too hot for too long. But that's just me, but there's certain groups of people that gravitate towards certain environments. You know, my part of my extended family lives in the barren wastelands of Minnesota and Wisconsin, and it's great for a visit, but I can't imagine having to deal with that cold all the time. So what's to say that, you know, this species didn't find the Pacific Northwest? Like you said, Mike, it's like the perfect environment for, like, hey, we have everything we need here. We have all the flora and fauna that we can either forage or, hey, like you said, we can watch these people. We'll just take from them.
Yeah, it's kind of fascinating. You know, I'm kind of sad, by the way, that as we are getting together here and we're recording, as of today, it is late October for us. On October 20th, apparently we missed National Sasquatch Awareness Day. Did you guys know such a day existed?
I was not aware.
Every day is Sasquatch Appreciation Day for me, so...
Well, this is Awareness Day. We always appreciate Sasquatch, but on October 20th, we want people to be aware of them, apparently.
Okay. Yeah,
that also...
You know why that is, though, right?
Why is that?
That's the anniversary of the filming of the Patterson-Gimlin film.
Was it now?
October 20th, yeah. 1967.
That's right, yeah.
There you have it.
Yeah, that's right. Two men, Patterson and Gimlin, in Bluff Creek, California... may have changed history with the best known footage of a still disputed animal species, one very human-like in appearance. We find the story fascinating, and apparently we try to raise awareness of this issue on October 20th. So a belated happy National Sasquatch Awareness Day to both of you and to all you guys out there in the listening audience. You know, another funny story I came across recently. I don't know how many of you out there have ever been down to Texas or if you've ever been to the area known as Lake Worth. But I've actually been to Lake Worth. I went down there with Lyle Blackburn and my buddies Kim and Kyle of the Expanded Perspectives podcast, and we went out to the famous location where sightings about actually half a century ago took place right there at Lake Worth, and there was, you know, again, a claim of a goat-like monster, a kind of goat man, which has sort of been appropriated as a kind of Bigfoot. That took place there, but there was this really interesting story that was published in the Fort Worth Star-Telegram by one Bud Kennedy. And according to what Bud wrote earlier this month, he said, more than 50 years after a furry, scaly creature emerged from a boggy lake, scared us all, and then vanished forever into urban legend, the readers of one California newsletter still think the Lake Worth monster was real. However, he said, I have some questions about their research. They also think I'm dead. Yeah. Now, the story's kind of weird. Apparently, Bud said that in the October issue of the Bigfoot Times, he had said that they had published a grainy photograph purportedly of this Lake Worth monster, and apparently had been talking about the story, the famous story. This is a photograph that's been, you know, widely published in a lot of different Sasquatch publications, books, you know, articles and things over the years. And as Bud describes it here, it's just a big white shape. He says it very well might be a giant labradoodle. But he notes the Bigfoot Times is curious because some published versions of the photo taken by the late Alan Plaster show the monster alongside a tree. And it looks very big. He quotes Danny Perez here of the Anaheim Hills-based Bigfoot Times. He says it's a mystery and no one has solved it. Nobody has shot one or killed it. Well, Bud goes on to quote Perez saying, apparently, that a 2006 column had said Plaster, quote, told the reporter, the late Bud Kennedy, that he felt that the matter had been a prank. Right, so Bud Kennedy is saying, I'm reading in the Times that the late Bud Kennedy, he said, hold on, I'm still alive. Why are they saying I'm the late Bud Kennedy? He said, Perez said he had heard about my death from Dallas Supernatural author Lyle Blackburn. He is the author of Boggy Creek Casebook and producer of documentaries on mysterious monsters tormenting small-town America. So he said in August, Blackburn had emailed, apparently, Kennedy, looking for Plaster. Kennedy said that he wrote back to Blackburn only this, died 10/25/19.
So weird.
I can see where the confusion was here. Apparently, he says that Lyle, Brother Lyle, had reached out to him and, you know, was asking about Plaster. Kennedy wrote back, died 10/25/19. I guess Lyle might have taken this to mean that someone was answering from Bud's email and saying, you know, he passed away. Didn't really give a whole lot of, you know, clarity, did he?
No, not really.
I mean, based on what Bud's saying, he wrote, he didn't tell him, oh, Mr. Plaster died on that date, but apparently that's what he meant. Yeah, so there was a little confusion, but I love how at the end of the article, he quotes Lyle apparently having reached out to him. He says, Blackburn paraphrased Mark Twain to offer this one nugget of fact. Yes, your death has been greatly exaggerated, he said, apologizing. So Bud seemed to have been a little offended that he had been reported dead, and he obviously doesn't seem to have very much time or tolerance for claims of Sasquatch or, you know, people who research it. But I mean, I'll just point out, I guess he could have been a little bit more forthcoming with information than just giving a date and saying died on that date. Leaves an awful lot to the imagination, doesn't it? But, you know, I mean, from my memory, I mean, when Lyle and I were down there at that location, I don't think Lyle necessarily says, oh yeah, the Lake Worth monster is real. I mean, it was pretty evident from talking with Lyle that he's like, you know, a lot of the stories are kind of questionable. The tale of the thing standing up there on this kind of hilltop and throwing a tire down. You know, he took me to the very spot and he said, yeah, it's pretty obvious that this was probably, you know, a local legend that got built up around a prank somebody played. Mm-hmm. Come on, have a sense of humor. But for God's sake, if somebody contacts you wanting to know where somebody is, don't just tell them somebody died on that
right.
date. Leaves a lot open for
a little more amplifying information would go a long way.
I mean, that could be a couple of different things. It's like, well, who died? Or is someone speaking to me from beyond the grave? I mean, what's going on here?
Did the Fort Worth monster die on that date?
Right. That would have been a natural conclusion. He's saying the monster died on that day, right?
So yeah, you know.
This is how rumors start, ladies and gents. That's all I'm saying. Look, I heard a rumor, by the way, that all three of us are going to be present and accounted for at CryptidCon this year. Really excited that we're going to make our way up there to the great state of Kentucky and spend some time. Hopefully meet a few of you fans out there who listen to this program. We, of course, love Kentucky. I was up there recently myself. And in fact, hanging out with some fantastic Bigfoot-minded researchers, a few of whom we hope to see there at CryptidCon also. But if you haven't got your tickets yet for CryptidCon, you'll definitely want to do that. Drop in, say hi. You'll see our great big Sasquatch Tracks sign that Dakota procured for us, so we are easy to spot. That, and of course, it helps that Jeff's like 8 feet tall, right? How tall are you, Jeff?
I'm part Bigfoot. No, I'm only 6 feet tall. I'm probably actually less than that now. I'm close to being the third tallest person in my house with my boys. They're catching up to me fast.
Oh, yeah. So you bring those squatchlings along with you at some point in the future. We might have to put them in fur suits. Maybe we'll get the Sasquatch kind of dark brown, but then we'll get one of the shock white with mud stains to match the Fort Worth monster look and have Jonah and Dewey each in one of these costumes.
Yeah, it'll be a traveling show.
I'm having visions of like Chewbacca and Lumperlump from the Christmas special. Jeez.
Yeah, exactly. Oh, man. Well, I know somebody who probably won't be able to make it so far south as Kentucky to meet us. That will be the fine folks from Chicago Bean Scene. I want to give them a shout out because they were kind enough to send some whole bean coffee to every one of the Sasquatch Tracks team. So if we are a little giddier than usual tonight, it's because, well, we have coursing through our veins all the caffeine of some fantastic Ethiopian coffee. Definitely check them out online. Just Google Chicago Bean Scene. They will deliver coffee to your home, and it's very good coffee at that. So we want to thank them, of course, for sending some to us here at Sasquatch Tracks. I also want to thank a few people who have been kind enough to send along donations to the program in recent days, leading off this month with $50. Dakota is our dear friend, Susan Davidson, down the mountain. Susan, of course, is often a night owl. She bakes fantastic cakes at night. And as she explains it, she often has the podcast on in the background while she is making cakes. So I told Susan, thank you for your donation. Next time we are down in Greenville, dinner is on me. We hope you and Mark and the kids are all doing great. You know, her younglings also, probably now taller than any of us, they could also don the Sasquatch suit, I think. But Susan is not alone this month. Also joining her is Rune, our good friend across the ocean in the land of ice and snow. He sends along $20 and also says, looking forward to the next show, guys. You're definitely on the right track.
Oh, Rune.
I see what you did, Rune. Watch out, I'll send Dakota over there. I mean it.
Don't tempt me with a good time.
That's right. Kate Zingarelli sends along $20. And then, of course, also we've got a bunch of rollover subscriptions from Sean Boyle, Teresa Storm, Brian Corbin, John Hickenbottom, our good buddy up in Ohio, and last but not least, Tracy McKim. So thanks to all of you who, in the month of October, have sent along your donations to Sasquatch Tracks. If I've missed any of them, I didn't mean to. Don't hold it against me. I've been traveling, and my brain, well, is mostly in my head, but my mind is still elsewhere. It's all slowly coming back to me, ladies and gents. And we're very glad, of course, for all of the support that you show. I think we're going to save our notes for next time. We did get a very interesting Black Panther sighting sent to us via email. I want to save that for another time, though. Maybe we'll get that in on the next episode, because right now we are looking ahead at a fantastic conversation with a really interesting researcher, and I think it's fair to call him a experiencer as well. Todd Neese is our guest. Many decades ago, he had a first-hand sighting while conducting a military training exercise in a controlled area. He's going to tell us all about this life-changing experience and how it made him a full-time Sasquatch researcher. We're going to talk about it all when we return right here on Sasquatch Tracks. Conversation that we've been looking forward to, and of course, a gentleman who has been very, very active for decades in this field of research. Todd Neese has been an active investigator into the Sasquatch question for nearly three decades. Born and raised in the Pacific Northwest, Todd had heard about these mountain giants all his life, although he never maybe gave the question of their existence much thought until the spring of 1993, when he had his own firsthand encounter. Now, since that time, he has described himself as a Bigfoot witness turned researcher who's conducted numerous investigations, including several long-term expeditions in the coastal, Cascade, and Blue Mountain ranges of Oregon and Washington, as well as Northern California, Arizona, Alaska, Nebraska, and British Columbia. But I'm going to have him tell you all about that. Our guest, Todd Neese, welcome to Sasquatch Tracks.
Thank you. I appreciate being on.
Yeah, it's really good to have you here, Todd. And again, you know, we've followed your work for quite a while. Todd, by the way, you were a sergeant in the Army's 1,249th Combat Engineer Battalion when your life forever changed. Before we get going on anything about Sasquatch, I want to take a moment to thank you for your service to our country. You're also an Iraq War veteran, aren't you?
I am. Thank you. And it's my pleasure.
Yeah. Well, I mean, that means a lot. And I think that's the most important thing. And during your line of service, this is such an interesting story because you are, of course, a combat engineer. And in 1993, you were in Oregon's Coast Range conducting a training exercise involving high explosive. And then something unthinkable happened. I'm going to turn it over to you at this point. Let's start right there. What happened in 1993 that changed your life?
Well, on April 3rd, 1993, to be precise, it was a Saturday afternoon, and I was, like you said, a combat engineer, sergeant with the 1249th Combat Engineer Battalion. And for your listeners that don't know, being a combat engineer means playing with a lot of explosives. It's part of our mission in mobility and counter mobility. And this was not really any different than any other training, with the exception that the quantity of explosives we were using that day required that we go out into this remote wilderness. And we utilized these gravel quarries that this private timber firm owned this large tract, and they had several gravel quarries throughout their holdings, and we had special permission to go on there, where we detonate anywhere from 200 to 400 pounds of explosives at a time, different explosives depending on the training scenario. And we had, like I said, three sites that had different scenarios, and we had already blasted the first two. They'd moved on to the third and final site for the day, being a cratering charge consisting of about 250 pounds of ammonium nitrate, and got it all set in, tamped it down, lit the fuses, and got in our vehicles and convoyed out of there for obvious reasons. But I happened to be a passenger sitting behind the driver in a Humvee. We were the second of four vehicles in this convoy. And our SOP, or standing operating procedure, was that we would rendezvous down at a safety staging area where we would await the explosion. You couldn't miss it miles away. And once we heard the explosion, we'd go back and check our work and do an after-action review. So while we're heading toward that staging area to await the explosion, I happened to have the window down. It was a beautiful, bright, clear day in April, which is pretty rare in the Coast Range. But I'd guess it was somewhere around 3 o'clock in the afternoon. And having lived in that area, I had hunted and fished and hiked all throughout that area, you know. And so it was just habit for me to look across the terrain and see if I could spot wildlife. Well, that day I got a little more than I asked for. As we came around this kind of slow sweeping clockwise corner, the second blast site, again, the one that we had detonated probably an hour earlier, came into full view. And what struck me as I'm looking down there are these three dark figures, obviously standing up on two legs, and they were right literally out in the open. They were literally nothing but rock background behind them, if you will. And my first instinct was, you know, what the heck are those people doing down there? Because we had two layers of security just to make sure civilians didn't get in the area. But I hardly got that thought out of my mind when on closer inspection, these weren't people at all. What I saw were three jet black, in other words, not wearing any sort of clothing or uniforms, black from head to foot, profiles. There were all three facing us, these three creatures. One in the middle stood taller than the two on either side of it, and I would estimate its height close to probably 9 feet or so. These other two weren't small by any means. They were probably seven and a half foot tall. And what really stood out, well, a couple of things. One was the profile they presented. These things looked like bodybuilders, just broad shoulders, barrel chest. You could see the waist taper down, you know, that barrel chest taper down to the waist. But I mean, what was off is these arms were down all the way to the knees, certainly longer than that of a human. And the legs too did not fit the profile of a human either. But it was the activity that pretty much, you know, settled it for me, because while that one in the middle, the tallest one, the biggest one, stood there like a statue, the two that flanked it left and right were exhibiting this swaying back and forth motion, rocking side to side like they were just, you know, shifting weight from one foot to the other. And in the process, these long pendulous arms are swinging back and forth at the knees, if not slightly below the knees. And they did this the entire time I watched them, and it wasn't some quick 3 to 5 second view. It was nearly half a minute. I estimate about 25 seconds I watched them. And again, these two were doing this Watusi. I don't know. They were just swinging back and forth, and that's just obviously not a human characteristic at all. And frankly, any human in that area, had they got through our security, would be an idiot to even bother going into that quarry, knowing that, or I should say not knowing that, there may be more follow-on explosions. So anyway, like I said, 25 seconds passed, and then the brush came back up as we finished the corner, and I was in shock. I just fell back into my seat and tried to, you know, figure out what, you know, 100 questions just swimming in your head. And you're just like, you know, that isn't supposed to be. And it really, really affected me in so much as it's opened my mind. And I've said many times, I cannot. It's hard to wrap my head around how 25 seconds of my adult life at that time, I was 34, changed. Everything changed just because of those 25 seconds. My associations and with people like yourself and where I live, who I married, I mean, all of it, it's just, if it wasn't for those 25 seconds, I don't know who I'd be today. I just know who I've become and what I've done. And it's a fascinating, fascinating quest. But just as a follow-up, because I think it's important, is when we got down to that staging area, my first instinct was to run back up the direction we just came. I wanted to, we weren't too far from that viewpoint, and I was hoping to get far enough to be able to see that quarry again. I just wanted to see it again. And unfortunately, due to protocols and accountability, everybody has to remain within eyesight of everybody else. We had to have 100% accountability just because of the safety factor.
Right.
So I went as far as I dared, and I tried my darndest to see over this little hill that was blocking my view. And while I was doing that, somebody calls out my name, and I look to my right, and here comes Sergeant Martin, and he walks up to me. Before he got there, he goes, "What are you looking at?" And I said, "Well, nothing." And he came right up to me and looked me straight in the eyes and goes, "I don't suppose you saw what I saw at that second blast site." And I said, "I don't know, Jeff, what did you see?" he went on to describe essentially what he said. I saw three huge hair covered Bigfoot, I guess. And of course at that I went, "Yeah, I saw them too, buddy." As time went on, again, being in the National Guard at that time, where we train 1 week in the month, our next drill wouldn't be till May. And lo and behold, when the May drill came around, there were two more soldiers that came forward and also admitted to having seen what Jeff and I had seen. So it's a rather unique sighting amongst sightings, just because of, certainly because of the nature of what we were doing. I mean, we were blowing up the woods. Sure. Three major explosions. But multiple animal sightings are fairly rare. Usually it's a single animal, and multiple witnesses are also fairly rare. So, you know, those three things combined has just made it an encounter that a lot of people are seem to be fascinated with, and I'm just happy to share it with you.
Yeah. You know, again, Todd, that's an incredible story. I am fascinated with military encounters with these creatures. And in fact, actually, over the years, I've come across a lot of those. I wanted to ask you, as far as what you saw, what was the rough distance between where you were as you were passing along? You had 25 seconds. What was maybe the closest that you were to the three subjects?
Well, I can almost give you the exact distance, give or take 10 meters, because and I'm glad you asked, because after all these years, it finally dawned on me that every time I, you know, was asked that question, I would just be, you know, guesstimating. And so I thought, hey, why don't I pull this up on the Google Earth app and see if I can find that quarry and find that road and use that measuring tool to try to figure out exactly how far it was. And it was a total, according to the measuring tool, it was 282, give or take again, 282 meters. Now, a lot of people say, well, that's a long distance. Well, keep in mind, in the military, in the Army, we regularly, annually train our marksmanship with the M16 rifle, no optics, at 300 meters. Mm-hmm. And we have to pick out targets that are, if you can imagine, they're kind of made out of a heavy plastic. It's half of a human torso. And on what we call a MARF range, they pop up at, you know, 50 yards, 100 yards, 150, 200, 250, and 300. And we're talking half of a life-size human torso, just from the waist up, if you will. And we have to tag them at that range. And, you know, I consistently hit those 300-meter targets. Don't ask me why I missed some of the 200-meter ones, but I've got great vision. And but suffice to say, a half of a human torso versus a full frontal silhouette, if you will, of these creatures, they were literally three times that size. Yeah. So I would say it would be probably equivalent of seeing them at less than 100 meters, but...
Yeah. What were the daylight conditions, Todd? What time of day and what kind of, you know, cloud coverage, what have you?
Well, like I say, it was about close to 3 o'clock in the afternoon, not a cloud in the sky. And I would say if these things were standing with the backdrop of forest behind them, I probably never would have saw them.
Sure.
But they're in this quarry that's basically basalt is the medium they use for their gravel. And that is like a light concrete gray color. Mm-hmm. And these things are jet black. With that background, the contrast was very stark.
Yeah. What do you think? And actually, before I ask you why you think they might have been there, I think that there's probably a pretty good clue offered by, you know, the noise that was being produced by what you guys were doing with the exercises. But before we get to that, I do want to ask you, this was, of course, you know, a controlled area. You're not going to have civilians probably that can enter this space, because had they done that, they would have been trespassing, correct?
Well, yeah, and had they done that, they probably would have been dead. This very large holding, land holding that this timber company at the time, it was Cavenham Forest Products, owned were hundreds of square miles. It's a very large tract of land, and they had on every entry very heavy gates with both sides of these very heavy heavy duty gates were ditched so that you couldn't get a vehicle around them. But just the protocol for us was, even though they had their own security, a number of security guards that drove trucks around that area, we had to place guards, armed guards, at all three main lines that went into that area, even though we only used one main line to come into the area and leave the area, just because the chance that civilians might try to get around those gates, we had to post armed guards at the two that we didn't even use, that were actually miles away. So the security was really quite heavy. But I think more to the point, a human, if you supposedly, let's say somehow you even accidentally got around the security, I would ask you, if you watched by this time two enormous mushroom clouds that went up 2,500, maybe 3,000 feet in the air, extremely loud explosion, I think it'd be safe to assume that there may be more to follow. Yeah. And the last place I'm going to voluntarily walk into is an area where this activity is going on.
Exactly.
Not being familiar with, you know, the schedules of our explosions and where exactly they're going to be.
Right.
But you bring up a good point, and certainly a lot of people have asked this question. In fact, I've asked it of myself before, and that is, under such circumstances, you would imagine every squirrel, fox, deer, elk, bear, cougar in that area is going to flee 360 degrees away from the source of that explosion.
Right.
Which brings the question, why? Now, an hour had passed, but at least an hour, I don't know that they weren't there 45 minutes or 30 minutes after the fact. I just know that it was an hour after the fact that I saw them. Why would any creature deliberately walk into that, you know, blast zone, if you will? And I believe personally that it was a matter of curiosity. And curiosity is, to me, looking for a reason, looking for answers, trying to figure out what's going on. And that tells me intelligence, because the need to know, I don't think falls on the mind of a raccoon or a squirrel.
Right.
They just get the heck out of there. But that to me tells me that in order to have that strong to have your curiosity peaked to the level that you're willing to take those risks, to take that chance to get the answers you're looking for, just tells me that they needed to know.
Yeah.
And it was more important than their own safety. Whether these were some sort of sentries that were sent out to get those answers and perhaps report back to other creatures as to what they saw, I don't know. But it's the only analogy that I guess I could think of when it comes to humans, if you will, that imagine you're sitting on your porch. Nice sunny Saturday afternoon, drinking a cold beer, and suddenly an airplane comes barreling out of the sky and crashes 5 blocks from your house. And you see the explosion, you see the smoke, you feel the ground shake. And yeah, certainly for a matter of a number of minutes, you're going to be in shock. You're going to be just traumatized by what you just witnessed. But over a period of time, I think whether it be for reasons of trying to help, see if there's any survivors, see if there's anything you can do, or just morbid curiosity, you will be drawn to that source of that traumatic event.
Yeah.
And I think that's what happened. I think a little time passed by, they realized that there wasn't going to be another one in quick succession to what had just happened. And they realized that we had vacated there, shortly after setting the charges. I think they got enough gumption and again, the curiosity was peaked to the level that they said, we got to check it out.
That's fascinating. And, you know, Jeff, I know you want to jump in here. I'll just add quickly also, Todd, that a number of factors are worthy of consideration that to me make this a very important observation. One, there was the fact that this was a controlled space, controlled entry with guards at various positions. It's highly unlikely that people are going to be able to enter the area. And further, even if they had, very unlikely that humans, especially non-military personnel, are going to linger around in an area where explosions may be happening. Nonetheless, the way that you but when you describe the intelligent behavior, again, not very like the way other animals would be presumed to behave, but not unlike how a human under the right circumstances, for instance, observing an air crash, perhaps from a distance like you describe, you know, that is almost human-like behavior. The fact that these creatures seem to exhibit that and were not afraid of the potential for an explosion not only seems to suggest these weren't necessarily people, but also the fact that people couldn't have presumably been there and that seems to be ruled out leaves few alternatives in terms of what else you might have been looking at. Then you add to it, of course, your description and that of the other servicemen who witnessed this, and this is an extraordinarily interesting sighting to me. Jeff, I know you want to jump in there. Go ahead.
Yeah, the question that popped into my mind was, do you think it was possible they were observing you and your colleagues setting the charges for the next one? I think I know the answer to this. I'm thinking maybe they're probably too far obstructed by the terrain, but I'm just wondering if maybe their curiosity was such that they were actually trying to see what you were doing at the time before you even left that area.
Well, I'm glad you asked that, because there was a situation that took place when we were at that second blast site, again, the one where they ultimately ended up appearing at. And that is, there were two squads, and I was a squad leader of one of the squads. At that particular site, we had inert or practice anti-tank mines that were laid out on the surface over this whole quarry. Our job was to run what they call a ring main, which is det cord that you tie your explosives into. So my squad was doing one ring main. The other squad was doing their ring main. We were setting blocks of C4 plastic explosive next to these mines. You didn't have to put them right on the mine, but if they're within a foot of the mine, it's going to detonate it. So we're all doing our thing, setting these explosives to breach a path, if you will, through this minefield. And when we do that, we train as we fight. That's just a a well-known saying in the military, you train as you fight. And there are certain disciplines, if you will, that you need to be careful of. Noise discipline, light discipline if it's dark, trash discipline, as if you don't want to leave any evidence of, you know, what you're doing when you do leave an area. But I remember clearly while we were setting these charges, I heard this very distinct sound. It was like, whoop! And I looked up and I just assumed it was one of my guys, for whatever reason, being stupid, and, you know, violating that noise discipline protocol. And I was looking for a butt to chew. But when I looked up, I realized all my guys had their heads down, focused on their work, setting their charges. And, you know, it seemed like it may have come from further back in the wood line. But again, it was before I ever had that sighting, you know. So it's one of these things in hindsight, because I distinctly remember that happening. And it makes me wonder if they were observing us while we were setting those charges and just how close they were to those charges when they went off.
Yeah, that's another good question, huh? Yeah, but again, the vocalization is also an interesting element, considering you hadn't thought, what was that? Was that a Sasquatch? You know, when you heard it in hindsight.
Of course. That's the last thing on my mind.
Right. And then in hindsight, it's like, well, but my guys wouldn't have been doing that out there. You know, again, in the middle of a very serious military training exercise with explosives, high explosives. Now, I have to ask also, Todd, have any of the other men that you were in touch with, have you been in touch with them since the initial sighting, or have any of them come forward and independently corroborated the story? Have you reached out to them at all?
As a matter of fact, yes. With the case of Sergeant Martin, I got introduced to a primatologist gentleman that was willing to entertain the idea of Bigfoot. In fact, had done a lot of research into Bigfoot. His name was Dr. Henner Fehrenbach.
Oh, yeah.
And Henner and I became friends, and he asked me one day, he goes, you know what, I'm putting on a class in the evening at Portland Community College on Bigfoot, and would you be willing to come share your story to the students in this class? And I did, and the very, I don't know, but I think it was like 6 months later, the class was so popular, they decided to do it again. And this time he asked me, do you think Sergeant Martin would be willing to come?
Wow.
And so I called him up and we met over his apartment. He said that I'd need a ride, but yeah, I'd do that. So he came and testified also, at that second class. And I think there was a third that followed on that too. But so he kind of came out of the Bigfoot closet, if you will, at this, the class. And then he and I have kept in touch over the years. I, my wife and I put on, we host a annual gathering of Bigfoot researchers. It's a private affair. Mm-hmm. That, and we can talk about that later if we have time, but, sure. It's a 4-day event we hold in the Oregon Coast Range called Beachfoot. And, this year will actually be our 15th annual gathering. So yeah, he's been one. The other two have been a little, reticent to come forward, which I totally understand. It took me a long time to decide to, like I say, come out of the Bigfoot closet, if you will, but, to answer your question, yeah, at least Sergeant Martin has gone public with it. Perhaps that's not so much as I have, but...
Sure, yeah, but I mean, it's interesting that there have been other people. You've kept in touch with them. They maintain that they also saw what you said that you saw that day. Now, I may be mistaken, but initially, I think having heard you tell the story before in the past, Todd, you didn't come out immediately and go tell the whole world, hey, I saw Bigfoot. You kind of kept quiet for a few years, did you not?
Oh, yeah, well, it's a funny story, but I mean, people like myself that have experienced something like that, you have to realize that it's a traumatic experience. It really opens your mind, I guess, in areas you'd never even consider. But I at the time, of course, being National Guard, again, it's one weekend a month, 2 weeks during this, you know, summer kind of thing. So we all have our 9-to-5 jobs. So not only was I a non-commissioned officer in the military, but I was a family man raising three young boys and a vice president of a shipping company in Portland. And I had worked very hard for my reputation, and I really struggled about going public about it, for obvious reasons. So you don't want people to ridicule you. You don't want people to question your integrity or even your sanity. And so, that's why I believe maybe 9 out of 10 people that see these things just keep quiet. And I get it. I do. But, I can also tell you it's a heavy burden to carry.
How so?
Well, to know that what you've seen is scientifically and historically extremely important, and yet to put your own personal feelings, your reputation, ahead of that. Well, it's kind of a conundrum. I have interviewed hundreds of people over the year, and it's amazing how many of them, you know, find out about me and my work, and they come talk to me, and I'm like, how long ago was this? Now they're like 40 years old. It's like, well, we were 16 and we're camped with the family. Who have you told? Well, nobody. You're the first. And, you know, you can't help but feel sorry for them, because they, like I, early on, was looking for an outlet to get it off my chest, but somebody that would not only take me seriously, but do something serious about it, to take the data, regardless of how old it is, and do something to apply it to research. And so I was the same way, and I just had to ask myself, you know, if I put this on a scale, on this side of the scale, here's Todd, here's this precious reputation. Yeah, he worked hard for it. You know, he's done great. He's moving up in his career, civilian wise and military wise. On this end of the scale, on the other end of the scale is groundbreaking, earth shattering, detailed eyewitness, multiple eyewitnesses, information about a species that is yet to be officially recognized. And I mean, it's a no brainer.
Yeah. That's admirable.
Is it going to be about me? Or is there something a little bigger than me? No pun intended.
Yeah. Oh, he's bigger than you, Todd.
Yeah. So when I looked at it that way, then I began looking for an outlet to talk to people about what I experienced and as the others had. And I came across a group. I was introduced to this group Western Bigfoot Society. They met monthly in Portland. It was kind of like a AA meeting for Bigfooters. And, you know, hi, I'm Todd. I saw Bigfoot. Get your coin.
Yeah.
Go home. But no, it's like, it was a great forum for people to feel comfortable and talk about what had happened with, you know, with them. And it just really surprised me how many people there were out there that, you know, I wasn't alone. And then one day I was going through the want ads in the paper, and there was this big, bold font word, Bigfoot, right smack dab in the middle of the page. And I'm like, okay. And I started reading it, and it was an outfit called the Bigfoot Research Project that was headed up by none other than Peter Byrne.
Yep.
Who still at 96 is still with us and still researching and writing books and whatnot.
Yeah.
They were advertising for a field researcher. And again, in hindsight, if I had any idea where I would be today, I would have jumped all over that. But I just saw that as a means of getting this off my chest and getting it in the right hands. And so I called them up. I told them what I'd experienced. They sent me a questionnaire. I filled it out, and they came out on a couple of occasions and investigated that area. And since I've become good friends with not only Peter and have actually gone and done expeditions and investigations with him over the last 28 years. But it was a call by Peter one day. He said, I've been asked to do a documentary and wondered if you would be interested in joining me. It's called Unsolved Mysteries. And, well, of course I had heard that. And I'm like, all right, I'll do it. And that was actually the first TV show I did back in 1994 with Unsolved Mysteries. And I've done, I don't know, dozens since.
Wow. And I was a kid at home, Todd, watching that. Unsolved Mysteries. The music alone on that show scared the crap out of me. But right. I mean, you know, but I'm telling you,
Robert Stack.
Yeah. If you or anyone you know has any information, contact Unsolved Mysteries. But I mean, I never missed it. And the Bigfoot episodes were the ones that were the most impactful on my life. Quite obviously, here we are having this conversation. So I saw you on television when I was knee-high to a June bug decades ago.
Yes, long time ago. And it's now that I'm retired, I've got more time to devote to public appearances. I do a lot of public speaking around the country. I've decided to make it. I mean, I have to look back at what happened and ask, why me?
Yeah.
Or what would have happened if we drove by 5 minutes earlier or 5 minutes later, or if I had been engaged in a conversation with the driver or the other fellow in the passenger seat up front. I mean, what if? And I'll tell you, I came to the point where I realized that there has to be a purpose. I mean, this just wasn't a personal peep show for me. This was meant to be. And so I have devoted myself not just in research as far as trying to gain personal evidence, but to... I honestly believe that the right goal, the right mission for myself and our nonprofit conservancy that we founded several years back is ultimately to get these things protected. And by that, I mean to get laws put on the books that will make it a very severe penalty for anybody who may decide someday to injure, harm, kill one of these things. And so that's really our focus right now is, well, I'll just say this. The mission statement for the American Primate Conservancy is the discovery, research, knowledge, recognition, and protection of these creatures. And it has to happen in that specific order. And right now, they've been discovered. We have research going on. We're gaining data and knowledge. We're at the threshold of recognition, and that's the, you know, kind of the third rail in Bigfooting. If we can get mainstream science to pull their heads out of the sand, if we can present evidence to the level that will get these creatures recognition as a viable species, only then can we get these laws on the books. Because let's face it, right now it's open season.
Yeah,
there's nothing out there really. I mean, yeah, there's been a few laws put out there, tongue in cheek, I think, more of a publicity stunt.
Sure.
That claim to have laws to protect them. And just recently, it was in Oklahoma, there was one congressman that was trying to pass a bill that would make it legal, actually, to kill them. Again, I think it was a publicity stunt, but I doubt it'll get a hearing. But
right,
I think that there's got to be a vehicle that whereby we can get these things protected. And one of the ways we at the Conservancy are doing is working with Native Americans. And I think that's the proper way to go. There have been people that have gone to, what's the right word, non-Native authorities and tried both here in the U.S. and Canada to present initiatives to get protections. And, you know, in the United States, it'd be the Department of the Interior that run both the Fish and Wildlife and the Forest Service and Bureau of Land Management and what have you. And then there's a Canadian counterpart, and every time they've been shot down. Well, what we're trying to do is kind of come at it through the back door, and that is to address these different tribes, more specifically those that are settled on reservations, where they have their own autonomy. They make their own rules. They're actually considered independent nations, if your listeners don't know that. Reservations, like Cherokee Reservation, is basically a Cherokee nation. And they get to set their own rules when it comes to natural resources and fish and game regulations and whatnot. And I put a lot of credence, a heck of a lot more credence than Native American information on these things than I ever would to anybody, any Westerner, if you will. We've been here maybe 300 years, and they've just recently discovered the oldest Native American settlement just literally 3 weeks ago that dates them back almost 23,000 years ago. Right. In the United States, which the very interesting thing about that is that we had an ice age 20,000 years ago, which means they survived it. And if they can survive it, certainly Bigfoot or Sasquatch could have survived it.
Oh, certainly. Absolutely.
Again. And so we put together a draft initiative, which is kind of plug and play as far as different tribes and different names that they call them. But it basically is about a 3-page initiative that has been scrubbed legally that actually puts some teeth into laws, at least within the boundaries of reservations. And we're working with 5 tribes now. And if we get these through, I think it'll spread like wildfire, because not only does it protect these creatures, which they all believe exist, they all have different names for them, and have lived symbiotically with them for 23,000 years, at least that we know of.
Right.
But it lends credence to their lore and their culture, and you know, and I say this kind of tongue in cheek, it also gives them a little way to poke the white guy in the eye a little bit and say, yeah, you say they don't exist, we know they do, and here's the proof. We've got laws. And once you get, if we can get several hundred of these reservations, both in the U.S. and Canada, to get on board this, what I think will catch on, then you can turn toward to the Department of the Interior and say, hey, I hate to tell you, but you're surrounded by Indians, or at least reservations, and they're all signing off on this. And I think it makes it a lot, it makes it a lot easier sale to them, if you will, to get them to at least put something on the books.
Well, it would be an undeniable,
so, just one of the projects.
Yeah, it would be an undeniable political movement at that point. And again, yep. You know, various different branches, I would imagine, of the Department of the Interior probably would have to take notice of that. Maybe the obvious one, the Bureau of Indian Affairs, but I mean, that might mm-hmm. extend also to, you know, some of the other agencies, National Park Service. I mean, you know, any number of others where, of course, federal land, presumably where, again, if it were ever accepted that these animals existed or there were any inclination to think that they might be there, even if there's no proof yet, nonetheless, you know, federal land and other, you know, elements would come into question with regard to federal government. So that is interesting to me. I think that's a very novel approach and a very important one. You know, again, let's talk a little about the conservancy that you and, of course, your lovely wife, who's also very involved in this area of research too, want to give her a shout out as well. You know, let's talk about the conservancy. And in addition to the political kind of approach that you've outlined, what else you guys do and how you operate?
Well, it's interesting. I've known Diane for a long, long time, just through the whole Bigfoot research. She's actually researched Bigfoot longer than I have, and she did most of her research in Florida, going back into her late teens, actually. And she founded her own organization and a website that was called Stalking Hominid Research. Mm-hmm. And I had ultimately in the '90s, I put together American Primate Foundation. And so as time went on and we got to know each other better, we ultimately became very good friends and decided to get married. And once we did, it was like, well, why do we have two websites? Why do we have, you know, we're just kind of duplicitous and we're on the same sheet of music, so let's combine them. And so we decided to just tweak the name a little bit to American Primate Conservancy. And I think that's a lot more apt than foundation because the keyword there is conservancy.
Right.
And so we did. And that was founded officially in 2015, and is designated a domestic nonprofit organization based on science and education. And the preservation part's a big part of it. Our annual conference is our kind of our public side of it, if you will. We do support of other cryptozoological groups as well. We've kind of adopted a friend of ours in, of all places, Papua New Guinea, who is studying prehistoric animals that he's discovered or heard of in Papua New Guinea, which is a chain of islands north of Australia. Mm-hmm. Very, very prehistoric, primitive area. A lot of it's been yet to be explored. And this gentleman has literally seen a pterodactyl that's been known for thousands of years by the natives called the Ropan.
Oh, yeah.
But it is some sort of a pterosaur, and he has actually seen it, and it did to him what Bigfoot did to me.
Oh, wow.
It's caused him to dedicate every dime and every resource he has to prove the existence of the rope. And so the Conservancy, we've shipped him more than a half a dozen game cameras, a parabolic microphone and recorder, night vision equipment, even a drone, and at time money if he needs to go from island to island and doesn't have the resources. And so that's kind of what, it's part of what nonprofits are about, is paying it forward or giving it back and helping out other people in the process. We're also working on, so we're experimenting with some things, doing a lot of field research now. Again, like I said, since I'm retired, I'm able to travel a lot more, and I've been researching in Alaska and Nebraska last year, which was phenomenal. I just got back from Oklahoma and Arkansas and Texas. We experiment. One of the things I'm experimenting with is we get a lot of stories of how some people, when they see Bigfoot, they either seem to appear from out of nowhere or suddenly disappear. And yeah, you got the paranormal folks that say, oh yeah, they're transdimensional and they can jump in and out of dimensions. And I'm like, no, I'm not, I can't go there, but I will look for a reason why they appear to do what you claim them to do. And one of the things I'm working with has to do with their, what I consider a very unique, camouflage.
Huh.
And what I've seen under the microscope on several hair samples that are, of course, backlit with white light, is that within a clump of hair, a sample of hair, I'm seeing a lot of clear hair shafts, to the point where if you've got a clear one over a couple other dark black ones, say, below it, you can see right through that. You can see the other hairs that are underneath it right through these clear shafts. And it got me to thinking, is it possible that if nature has, for whatever reason, incorporated a certain percentage of their hair to be hollow, not so much hollow, that's not the right word, but you know what I mean, clear.
Mm-hmm.
It's not for no reason. Nature always has a purpose in what it does. So what possible purpose can it have? And the thought to me was, hey, if I infused, 25, 30%, 40% of the hair in a massive creature like that, or it doesn't have to be that big, but would they not act similar to that of fiber optic cabling? In other words, would they not have a tendency to absorb, transfer the surrounding colors and light conditions and in effect block out what's behind it? And so we purchased 1,000 feet of fiber optic cable that we have here, and we are experimenting with it. We're going to work with taxidermists, see if we can get, say, some bear hide, and take pictures of it under certain light conditions, certain different colored backgrounds and whatnot, and then take that hide and start infusing from behind, you know, through the hide, a bunch of these little fiber optic fibers, and take under the same light conditions or the same background and surrounding colors, see if that doesn't create a fade effect, if you will, with these clear shafts, again, picking up the color and light around it and in effect blocking the darker hair behind it.
Almost like a kind of natural variety of active camo.
Or as some people say, cloaking. I would say if my theory is correct, and we'll experiment with ever increasing volumes of percentage of clear shafts, you know, not real dissimilar to that of a real heavy monofilament fishing line, but you get the point.
Mm-hmm.
It's going to conduct that light through it. That's what fiber optic fibers do. They pick up the light on one end and transfer it out the other. So we'll see. I think if something had that ability, or it just was built into its coat, that if it stood still, it'd be nearly impossible to see.
Well, certainly, but I'll just, you know, even simplify it further. I remember some footage online a number of years ago where, again, this was making the rounds on YouTube. The military is using active camo because you see nothing, and then all of a sudden something sort of in the shape of a man runs across the screen, and then you see a discernible human shape. What it actually was a guy in his desert fatigues. I mean, it was regular camo. This wasn't any kind of experimental technology. It was camouflage doing what camouflage does. But in that circumstance, at that distance, against that kind of backdrop, it performed beautifully. I've also seen a fawn, you know, a baby deer standing in the woods. And it took me a few minutes to see it because those white spots, you know, they look just like the sunlight coming through the trees, and it blends in perfectly. Nature does a remarkable job. Biology is very good at camouflage. And hey, folks, don't take my word for it. Ask a tree frog. Ask a gecko. You know, ask a squid. Some animals can literally
ask the chameleon or the octopus.
They can change their color to match their environment. So, I mean, it may not be so far out that there is indeed a simple biological explanation. Jeff, I know you wanted to jump in. Go ahead.
Todd, are you friends with Doug Hychek at all?
Yes, I am. In fact, I'm working on a documentary with him.
Okay, so he's kind of floated this same concept. Exactly. That's what I was going to say. He's been posting some things to his Facebook page that are right in line with what you're discussing as far as like fiber optics, and they're going so far as to observing the hair, supposed, you know, Bigfoot hair, through a camera of some type, but also while illuminating it with UV light, and it has a particular glow, a pink glow to it, which I think is fascinating. If we're able to work out some means to use that as a way of detection, or even just proving if some sample is actually Bigfoot hair or not.
On that subject, really quickly, Todd, I also want to ask you, as far as the hair samples that you're using, are these samples that have been analyzed and that turned up no positive ID for any known species? What kind of hair samples are we talking about?
Well, these were actually photographs that were sent to me. Now, I have received physical hair samples in the past, and I have divvied them up and sent them to different geneticists in hopes of getting kind of a triple blind study, if you will, only for them to get lost, which just blows my mind. But the particular samples I'm talking about, I've got a collection of pictures that were taken through a microscope of various hair samples. And there was several that exhibited this clear shaft phenomena within a clump of hair. And again, I'm like, nature doesn't randomly do anything. It does everything for a purpose. And it's usually survival based. And so the specific ones I'm talking about are photos that I've received and looked at. And I'll tell you another one too that really intrigued me was this one clump of hair where a fairly large percentage of it appeared to be, again, under a microscope, so magnified, again, backlit with bright white light, that seemed to have some sort of I hate to use this word, but just for lack of a better word, glitter, if you will. And because white light has within it every color of the rainbow, these shafts of hair that seem to be, again, coated with microscopic glittery substance that reflect light has got me thinking on a whole nother track that if you have hair, then again, if you held it in your hand, you wouldn't even see it. But under a microscope, if it had microscopic reflective crystalline structure to it. Could it possibly act as a mirror, if you will? And I've seen experiments done with mirrors in the woods, and it's amazing. Because if you hold a mirror out, if you say you're standing out in the field, and you hold a mirror straight up, if somebody's out there holding a mirror straight up, you're going to see your reflection, right?
Sure.
But you tilt that mirror about 20 degrees down, and you disappear.
Yeah.
Because it picks up all the foliage and the colors and the light in front of it, and just makes it look like a continuum. Yeah. And in fact, I saw recently a fairly new design in a hunting blind that uses that same kind of technology. It basically forms a downward facing circle of mirrors around you, and a person could stand behind it and you would not know they're there at all. You wouldn't even detect it. I mean, even if you look closely, it just looks like a continuous field until the person behind this, again, forward-facing array of mirrors stands up, and it's like they just appeared out of nowhere.
Yeah. Well,
I don't know. Maybe, you know, I don't know. We've got to not just use conventional theories and conventional methods of research, but kind of think outside the box and try different things.
Well,
got it right just yet.
Yeah. No. Again, Todd, really, I like the approach. Many would say, why are we, you know, extrapolating on all these seemingly far out possibilities? But back to what Todd was pointing out, there are these descriptions that seem very anomalous. And unfortunately, you know, we talked with Dr. Melderman about this, and he said, you know, unfortunately, I think that a lot of people hear those kinds of accounts, and then they go, well, therefore, they must be ghosts of some extinct primate species, or they're interdimensional, or they are, you know, the pets of aliens that were dropped off in flying saucers.
Exactly.
And, you know, again, before we leap to those conclusions and try to start using unprovable explanatory mechanisms, let's stick with biology and say, okay, what within the scope of biology can we create that will help us explain this? Now, look, Todd, I know your time is very valuable. In terms of your strategy, I know you've likened your proposed strategy to icons in the field like Jane Goodall. You say essentially, you know, we need to insert a small research team into the heart of prime Bigfoot habitat for an extended period of time. You know, put people out there. What happens when you do that? What are you aiming to achieve in the long term?
Well, you know, I used to think that these things were related to the Gigantopithecus. This is the one theory that Dr. Melgram had floated for a while, as well as the late Professor Grover Krantz and others. And over time, I have come to conclude that this species or subspecies of perhaps us are an ancient people, a relic hominid. By that I mean something in the hominid species, and not the human line to speak of, but the hominid lineage, such as Cro-Magnon, the Denisovans, Neanderthal, that have somehow been able to survive where others have not. And it's a lot of that comes from my studies with Native Americans and the fact that when they describe them, they call them the first ones or the old ones, but they didn't talk about them as they did other animals. They talked about them as another tribe. Along those lines, they seem to be very curious and at the same time threatened by us. But I've always said their curiosity is their Achilles heel.
Right.
Because it's those times where they get too curious that they get caught.
Chasing bomb blasts, maybe, for instance.
Yes, and an extraordinary circumstance in itself. But I said, you don't find Bigfoot. Bigfoot finds you, and you just happen to find out that they're looking at you, and they're checking you out. And right. usually when they've been exposed, they generally turn and walk away. But it seems to me somewhere in between is this need to communicate, to maybe in some way reunite with our species, possibly knowing that it's inevitable, and wanting to have some control over that inevitability. And I just would like to make sure that we're prepared for that and that we respect that, and that if and when that time comes, that it could be done in a respectful way.
You know, Todd, right now, a lot of astronomers are looking through their telescopes, trying to find evidence of other intelligent life in the universe. Last question, would you argue that we need look no further than right here on Earth? We may have another intelligent species right here in our midst?
To be honest with you, I don't think we've really scratched the surface. I think it's disingenuous to suggest that we are the be all end all of scientific study. And all you need to do is study not only the new species that are being found every year, but on the other end, let's look at extinction and the history of extinction. And yeah, extinction is every bit a part of life as creation or adaptation or evolution. But much of it has been done at the hands of man, and either out of greed or ignorance. And we're learning, sometimes too late, that we have an effect on this planet and on its inhabitants. And we have a responsibility to be humble about that and to do whatever we can to prolong a species, or more to the point, not push them toward that extinction. But like I say, it's a two-edged sword. There are revelations, there are discoveries happening every year that people generally don't hear about. And it's time to open our eyes and maybe open our hearts and start being the custodians that we should be when it comes to this little blue rock in space, because I really don't think we've even scratched the surface.
Something tells me you're right. Very well said, and an equally great time spent with Todd Neese. I want to thank you again for being our guest here on Sasquatch Tracks.
Oh, it's been my pleasure. Anytime.
Well, not only describing such a fascinating experience in the environment that he saw it in this military training exercise, I really enjoyed kind of the capstone of the conversation that we had with Todd, kind of looking at it more from like the stewardship perspective of like, well, if we are quote unquote the top of the food chain at this point, and we are the ones who affect the planet the way that we do, you know, it's kind of our job to look out for a species that, you know, that either A, may be really close to us, or B, we could be pushing to the brink of extinction just by our own actions. Thought that was like a really, really compassionate and interesting perspective. I've never really thought about it that way. It gave me a lot to think about towards the end, because I've never really thought about like our role as stewards towards Sasquatch research.
Right. I mean, I actually have quite a bit, and, you know, admittedly, recognize though I do the necessity for having a specimen, you know, and science needing to have that before they can recognize the species, I just have never really been comfortable with the idea of killing one of these things.
No, I haven't either. And it just seems wrong, you know, and even going back to all the accounts that you hear from hunters that actually have weapons in their hands and have a creature in their crosshairs, you know, to a person, they all say that, you know, I couldn't do it because it felt like it was too humid. And I want to take this time to clarify real quick, you know, Todd did mention the law that the Oklahoma Congressman Humphrey wanted to to enact. I think it initially it was called like a some kind of Bigfoot hunting law, so I can see where there's some misunderstanding. We discussed it on a show where it really turns out that they're not going to issue any kind of hunting license for killing these things. It's more for, you know, the safe capture. Really, it's more for tourism, but the wording is, you know, it's for the safe capture of a creature to prove that they exist. So now there's the law there in Oklahoma isn't going to allow for shooting these creatures.
Yeah. As it turns out, the congressman in question actually came out later and he clarified. He said, we don't want anyone to kill these things. We want people to go out and look for them, hunt for Bigfoot, just like you'd go on an Easter egg hunt. So,
right.
So we just add that as a bit of clarification. Although, you know, I think Todd's point absolutely still stands in other areas where no such legislation, you know, whether it's tongue in cheek by intent or not, there are many other instances where people could actually go out there and presumably kill one of these things. Again, it's a difficult question, really, because many would say it has to happen. None of us really like the idea, but it's going to have to happen because then science will recognize them. And then we can finally say it's against the law. Protect them. Never kill one ever again. They are a protected species. But then again, there are also those who would say, would even that be enough to garner protection for these species? I'm very interested in what Todd had proposed about trying to get different, you know, bands of indigenous American groups throughout the country involved in protecting them on reservation land.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that's an interesting approach as well. And of course, we always like to hear from the many naturalists, the many biologists, archaeologists, and people who listen to this program. I understand many of you out there are very interested in the topic. You can't put your name behind it for obvious reasons in terms of your profession, but for people who are out there in the professional side of this and who might have ideas on protecting a species or garnering attention for or recognition of one, we'd love to hear from you also, and you can write to us. You can use the contact form right there at SasquatchTracks.com. While you're there, if you like the program, of course, as always, we ask you to consider maybe sending along a donation to us that will help to further our efforts here at the Appalachian Institute for Hominology Studies. And of course, if you want to put those booger bucks behind something that gets you a little something to show for it, just check out the store link while you're right there at the website. You can buy a t-shirt, a coffee mug. All kinds of different things are available there at the Sasquatch Tracks store. All right, guys. Well, that about wraps up another edition of the podcast. Thank you, Jeff. Thank you, Smo. I'll see you
guys. Always a pleasure.
Yes, indeed.
Thank you.
I'll see both of you guys at the movies. Apparently, we're going to go see Boggy Creek or something here in the next few days. But whatever it is, I'm sure it'll be a good time. And we'll see all of you out there who are able to make it at CryptidCon. Drop on by in Kentucky. We'll be there. Sasquatch Tracks team on site. From your friends here at the Appalachian Institute for Hominology Studies, Sasquatch Tracks will return.